This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, October 14th, 2003. Like any good spy story, the outing of Valerie Plame Wilson is far more complex than it seems on the surface. "She's a hell of a shot with an AK-47, said her classmate Jim Marcinkowski, that is, her classmate from the CIA training farm, Camp Perry. This begins an article, Secrets of the Scandal, by Nicholas D. Kristof in the New York Times, October 11, 2003. She turns out to be skilled in throwing hand grenades and to have lived abroad and run covert operations in some of the world's messier spots, says Nicholas Kristof. Today we begin part two of Outing the Gentlemen Killers of the CIA. Last week we discussed more about Valerie Plame Wilson and her husband, who had been at one point an ambassador to Gabon, at another point the
deputy chief of mission in Baghdad, Maya, and not only that, but director of African Affairs in the National Security Council. These are not minor figures. They are not analysts. These are not only operatives, but they're in charge of covert ops in many theaters and over a sustained period of time.
According to Nicholas Kristof, it may have been that Mrs. Wilson, that's Valerie, also called Valerie Plame, had actually been outed by Aldrich Ames, along with many other spies, and her name given to the Russians before Ames's arrest for espionage in 1994. As Kristof writes, her undercover security was undermined at that time, and she was brought back to Washington for safety reasons.
And Maya, there's a specific reason for that, because as Kristof reveals, she was brought back to Washington because she was skulking along the back alleys of Beirut and Algiers in covert operations of which she was a director and a very well-trained, hands-on operative. That means with not just hand grenades and not just the paraphernalia of sabotage, but with the means of killing. These are figures who are part of the arsenal of imperial design, covert ops who sabotage, who organize hits, who take out people. This is the nature of the Central Intelligence Agency, and its instrumentality is the vehicle through which the ruling class destroys popular movements, overthrows governments, murders people in their beds, and carries out a sustained reign of state terror on behalf of U.S. imperial rulers.
An interesting article by Warren Strobel appeared in the Knight Ridder newspapers on the 12th of October, entitled "Breach Puts Lives at Risk, Insiders Say." And in it, he elaborates more on the history of Valerie Plame and her relationship to the CIA. Born in 1963, which would make her 40 years old now, she graduated from Pennsylvania State University and was quickly recruited by the CIA, attending training classes in 1985. By 1990 and in 1991, Plame was attached to the U.S. Embassy in Europe. And if you will recall, last week we discussed in detail how CIA operatives work undercover of the State Department assigned to the various embassies, and also they work under the Commerce Department, with the Commerce Department setting up agencies in countries, in each country throughout the world. Now, according to address records, it suggests that she operated under official cover for quite some time. And Knight Ritter actually accumulated the address records, but voluntarily they withheld the precise location of the embassies. Now, Plain's name didn't appear in the State Department telephone and the embassy directories from that period, but Knight Ritter is stating conclusively that she was operating undercover, under official cover for the CIA at a U.S. embassy in Europe. Also, it's important to note that the CIA spends quite a bit of money in training their operatives. Minimally, in the first session, at least $350,000. But to train a full-scale killer and operative, it costs in the millions of dollars.
And Maya, the Warren Strobel Knight's written a report of October 12th doesn't mince words. Plame's career was as a covert operations officer in the CIA Directorate of Operations. As you have been indicating, this had a series of covers, a specific cover being the Brewster Jennings and Associates, which is an example of a proprietorial organization, a CIA front, of which there are an enormous number. In every country in the world, there are nominal private organizations, research institutions, non-governmental organizations, corporations, which are, in effect, proprietorial companies of the Central Intelligence Agency. Let us be very clear about it. The institutional nature of U.S. capitalism and its rule, in whatever nominal heading it chooses to assign itself, is performing the function of the murder squads, the covert ops, the subversive conduct of operations intended to eliminate opposition, to destroy people who are but advocates of social change, to compromise governments that are not sufficiently compliant. That is the dynamic. That is the meaning of the functioning of these people.
And Ralph, most of all, the purpose of the CIA is to undermine any national liberation struggle that is taking place throughout the world. And that is well documented by William Agee in his seminal work, Philip Agee. Oh, what a day. Philip Agee in his seminal work, Inside the Company, where he describes his own efforts in Ecuador in exposing the resistance movement in Ecuador that led to their brutal torture. And that was, for him, an epiphany when he happened to be in a police station and the very people who he of whom he had given information were being tortured. Now, Brewster Jennings and Associates, the very company under which Valerie Plame was working recently, the CIA front company, Vince Canestrero, formerly the CIA's chief of counterterrorism operations and analysis, said that to the Knight Ritter newspapers that this was a company that other CIA officers had been using. But what's also interesting is that while many of the CIA front companies, such as Air America, actually carried out a business, Air America being a transport company, Brewster Jennings and Associates, when reporters went to the address, checked out the address and the phone number for Brewster Jennings and Associates, the very building where it was supposed to have been located, the building manager said he had never heard of this company, and there was no phone listing.
By the way, Maya, since you brought up Air America, I think it's essential to point out to people that Air America was the CIA company that was running the drugs and the heroin out of Southeast Asia in a regular mail run, virtually, from Laos and from Indochina into the United States. In fact, not only was the CIA proprietorial airline running heroin, but they were actually taking the bodies of U.S. soldiers and eviscerating them and stuffing the corpses with heroin, where these bodies would be met by military personnel at JFK and the heroin removed from the corpses. That gruesome detail of the nature of the gangster state was disclosed by Dick Gregory and myself in the years when it was occurring during the Vietnam War, and it has long been acknowledged and has been written about by many people, but the point being that Air America and these proprietorial organizations preside over the operations of a criminal gangster clique, which is this ruling class. And we emphasize this in almost every program that we have brought to Pacifica, because we have seen in the recent disclosure of the Bush administration's outing of Valerie Plame that people have then sought to romanticize the figures who have been fingered by the central by the Bush administration or whomever, and that I think is a fatal flaw.
The falling out among the thieves.
Yes, the squabbling over the spoils. Because let's be extremely clear about this: there is a significant wing of the ruling class that includes Brent Scowcroft, that includes Norman Schwarzkopf, that includes many of the criminal figures in the ruling class who were involved in the most nefarious operations in the first Gulf War and in the setting up of Saddam Hussein and in the instigating of the Iran-Iraq conflict and of all of the perfidious operations of U.S. imperialism in destroying regimes, in installing Saddam Hussein, in organizing the murder of Abdulkarim Qasim and the destruction of the Iraqi Revolution of 1958. The crimes that lay at the door of U.S. imperialism are also the actual work product of people like Joseph Wilson IV and his spouse, Valerie Plame. And when these people, like Brent Scowcroft and the like, have taken their distance from the neocons and from the agenda of dismantling each government client state in the Middle East, fragmenting them, the neocon agenda, the agenda of the Likud, the agenda of the Mossad, the agenda of that wing of capital that considers that they no longer can afford, no longer can pay for, no longer can tolerate the intermediate regimes that have been the administrative instrument. These people are engaged in a tactical dispute about how best to work imperial rule. And so when they are outed in an internecine conflict, yes, make use of the fact that they disclose that the Niger uranium cake pretext for invasion was a fraud, but every single act of these very people in the course of their careers has engaged in disinformation on the part of the Central Intelligence Agency, targeting people who they have demonized in advance. The murder of Mehdi Ben Barker, my friend in Morocco, the leader of the socialist movement in Morocco, is at the hands of the people like Valerie Plame. What was she doing skulking in the back streets of Rabat in Morocco, carrying out the mandate of Central Intelligence Agency covert operations in North Africa? What was the fate of many of the leaders of the Algerian Revolution, but at the hands of people like Valerie Plame and her Mossad counterparts in the years of destruction of resistance in Algeria? Let's be very clear about this. In exposing the internecine conflicts and the meaning of those conflicts within the ruling class, it is fatal to romanticize them, and even more so to use the felony legislation of 1982, which was designed to shut up people like Philip A.G., like Lewis Wolf, like ourselves, like everybody who attempts to expose the nature of capitalist rule, to silence us, to prevent us from naming names. That's the purpose of that legislation. Let us now invoke it, because its real target is all of us.
In terms of naming names, today we are going to discuss the target Syria and target Iran and target Venezuela. The operations of the CIA in against these countries. And in terms of naming names, I'd like to refer to Wilbur Crane Eveland. Wilbur Crane Eveland, who worked for the CIA for many years in the Middle East under Kermit Kermit Roosevelt, who was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, and Kermit Roosevelt was the chief of operations in the Middle East. Now, in Ropes of Sand, a book to which we've referred when in discussing Iraq because of Wilbur Crane Evelyn's revelations about Saddam Hussein as the CIA's man in Baghdad, particularly in the staging of the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasem. But in Ropes of Sand, America's Failure in the Middle East, Wilbur Crane Evelyn names specifically about the operations of the CIA to undermine Syria. He speaks of particularly the work of the United States and Great Britain. George Kennedy Young was the deputy director to Major General Sir John Sinclair, the nameless chief of MI6, known to all but a few in Britain as the letter C. C meaning he was the chief who was in charge. Now, Young had said that Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria threatened Britain's survival. This was in 1956. That their governments would have to be subverted or overthrown. Mind you, 1956, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria threatening Britain's survival.
Maya, let me mention at this point, don't want to interrupt, but there is a book that's just been published by Stephen Kinzer, the New York Times correspondent, called All the Shah's Men. Now, he is also the author of a prior book called Bitter Fruit regarding the Central Intelligence Agency putsch in Guatemala in 1954. And the predicate for that was what you've described in 1953 with Kermit Roosevelt, which was the overthrow.
56. I'm talking about the 53, right.
The 53 with the overthrow of Mossadegh and the installation of the Shah. That was the premier Central Intelligence Agency putsch and assassination campaign. And by the way, the people who were involved in the 53 and the 54, the Kermit Roosevelts and the E. Howard Hunts, would feature then in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And we're going to detail the role of the Central Intelligence Agency in internal assassination in November at the time of the 40th anniversary of the execution of the John F. Kennedy, absent any romanticizing of the Kennedy brothers, you can be sure. But notwithstanding that, the fundamental point is that All the Shah's Men, as it's described by the publisher half a century ago, the United States overthrew a Middle Eastern government. The victim was Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister of Iran. Although the coup seemed a success at first, it serves as a chilling lesson of what the consequences of foreign intervention. And indeed, the account is centered on the reconstruction of the events and how the assassinations across Iran prepared for the overthrow of the regime. Mr. Kinzer, a veteran correspondent for the New York Times, lays out the names of the operatives. He names the names, and that is the fundamental point. None of this work, none of this investigative work would be possible if we do not challenge the attempt to silence our naming the names of these criminal gangster operatives of American imperialism in every arena.
Ralph, it's a good thing you mentioned 53 so we can be in a historical timeline. And one of the little known facts about the 53 coup in Iran is that British Petroleum had been active with the oil resources of Iran prior to 53, and as a result of the U.S. control and with the displacement of Mossadegh, who was nationalizing the oil, the United States oil companies moved into Iran. Now, back again to other parts of the Middle East, because here we have the British colonial empire trying to regain control in the Middle East, as well as working with the United States to gain control and divide up the spoils. So we have Young, George Kennedy Young, the deputy director to the chief of MI6, meeting with the Americans to discuss Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria as the next targets. What Young said was that the governments of these three countries would have to be subverted or overthrown. Iraq was the central point of British support and area stability because you had their stooge, Nouria Saeed, in position, and they wanted to strengthen him as quickly and as much as possible, according to Evelyn's report. Turkey and Iran were also considered allies because of the recent coup in U.S.-sponsored coup in Iran, and that they would help with the British action. So what they were saying is they would first target Syria and then proceed to an overthrow of King Saud next. And with Nasser, they were coming with plans for his assassination.
So we see here, Maya, just to make the point, that each country in the Middle East has been at every conjuncture targeted for assassination of its leaders and even for the removal of the government in place. So there is always the agenda of imperialism to remove any authority that is not sufficiently compliant and to contemplate seriously direct military control of their resources.
Now let's go to how they would do it, because this is what you're going to find is greatly similar to what is taking place today with the target of Syria and Iran. They were going to stage border incidents with Turkey. The Iraqis would stir up the desert tribes, and the Parti Populaire Syrian in Lebanon would infiltrate the borders until mass confusion justified the use of invading Iraqi troops. Already, Young said, they discussed all of this with their prospective participants, and as well, they had discussed this with the Israelis. Now, Young said that the meetings were taking place at the highest level of the British cabinet. And in the United States, this was all happening under Alan Douglas. Dulles, the head of the CIA, and Kermit Roosevelt. And they were in meetings with Selwyn Lloyd and the SIS, which was a division of British intelligence. Now, this is 1956, and to incorporate the press, what Evelyn did is he met in the United States at the St. George Bar with Cyrus I. Sulzberger and Joseph Alsop and Homer Bigart of the New York Times. And he planted with them information about the border incidences, and also with Sam Brewer of the New York Times. And Sam Brewer is the one who left for Syria and ended up promoting the CIA's agenda in Syria.
Which amplifies the seminal disclosures of Harrison Salisbury in his Gentleman Killers of the CIA, when he noted the role of the New York Times and of the main establishment media in servicing to provide disinformation handed and ordered by the Central Intelligence Agency. Much of the feature stories in the mainstream press preceding major U.S. interventions is the disinformation of the CIA assets that are within the key placements in New York Times and other such media.
Now, one last point about Evelyn's report. The operation was called Operation Straggle, and a group, the Omega Planning Group, was set up in the U.S. State Department. So we had involved here not just the CIA under Alan Dulles, but also the U.S. State Department. And part of this included, quote, the elimination of leftist officers from the Army. Now, I want you to note this because recently, September 27th, 2003, an important article by Ben Fenton appeared in The Guardian in Great Britain, Macmillan-backed Syria assassination plot. Ralph?
Yes, and that is very evocative, Maya. I mean, it has a particular meaning for me because it deals with the private papers of Duncan Sands, who was Macmillan's defense secretary. And those were the years when I first went to Great Britain and was working with Bertrand Russell, and I had the opportunity to confront Duncan Sands in 1959 at a conference over then CIA and MI6 plans in Africa to murder Ogingo Dinga and other leaders of the National independence movement in East Africa and so on. We confronted him with the data. He fulminated about communist subversion, but he couldn't refute the documentation. And here we have, as you say, on the 27th of September in The Guardian, Macmillan-backed Syria assassination plot. Parenthetically, I should mention to you that Bertrand Russell in 1962 gave a speech at the Birmingham Youth Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament upon the disclosure that John F. Kennedy and Macmillan were contemplating a preemptive nuclear war against the Soviet Union, with a specialized report prepared by Robert McNamara that estimated that the U.S. would win World War III at the cost of 160 million American lives, 90% of Europe's population, the insanity of this gangster state. At that time, Russell gave a speech in which he said Kennedy and Macmillan were worse than Hitler. He was much pilloried for that. But he said, never had the Nazis put into play the kind of genocidal campaign that would have extirpated 90% of Europe's population, not to mention 160 million North Americans. Coming back to the fundamental point here of this article, 50 years before the war in Iraq, the article begins, Britain and America sought a secretive regime change in another Arab country. They accused of spreading terror and threatening the West's oil supplies, planning the invasion of Syria and the assassination of its leading figures. The newly discovered documents show how. In 1957, Harold Macmillan and President Dwight Eisenhower approved the CIA MI6 plan to stage fake border incidents as the excuse for an invasion of Syria. The plans, frighteningly frank in their discussions, were discovered in the private papers of Duncan Sands, Mr. Macmillan's defense secretary, by Matthew Jones, a reader in international history at Royal Holloway University of London. And indeed, this article, which is extraordinarily evocative and important because of its detailing of the criminal nature of the Central Intelligence Agency, MI6, at the behest of the rulers of capital in the United States and Great Britain. They had prepared to topple the regime in the autumn of 1957 through the assassination of three leading figures, which was, as the article states, at the heart of the scheme. In the document drawn up by a top-secret high-level working group that met regularly in Washington in September 1957, Mr. Macmillan and President Eisenhower are left in no doubt about the need to assassinate the top men in Damascus.
The men were Abd al-Hamid Sarraj, the head of Syrian military intelligence, Afif al-Bizri, chief of the Syrian General Staff, and Khalid Bakhtash, leader of the Syrian Communist Party. Now, it's important to consider why they were going after Syria. Syria was the location of an important pipeline that's recently been shut down by the United States after the takeover, the occupation of Iraq. And this is a pipeline that moves the oil from Iraq to the Mediterranean, and also it goes from Iraq to Turkey. Ralph?
Yes, and what this article goes on to say is driving the call for this action was the CIA's Middle East chief, Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of former President Theodore Roosevelt, the man who organized the CIA assassination program and the coup d'etat in Iran, in Tehran, in 1953. And it was Kermit Roosevelt who identified Colonel Sarraj, General Bisri, and Mr. Bakhtash as the real power in Syria, the men to be eliminated. The preferred plan stated, quote, once the political decision is reached to proceed with instigating internal disturbances in Syria, the CIA is prepared and an SIS MI6 will carry out sabotage and coup de main incidents throughout Syria, working through contracts with assets and individuals. It is not the crisis which has changed, nor is it the evil which is new. The very program that is now being prepared for Syria and Damascus today is the continuation of the policy of murder and sabotage and the destruction of governments and the elimination of popular leaders and the complete decimation of movements for social change in every arena of struggle of the oppressed, and in particular in the oil-rich Arab East.
So here we have in this article by Ben Fenton documenting the discoveries of the papers of Duncan Sands, confirmation of what Wilbur Crane Eveland was writing in Ropes of Sand. The relationship between the CIA and SIS, which is MI6 in Great Britain, comparable intelligence operations, to undermine and to take over Syria. Now, part of the plan was funding of a Free Syria Committee. Does this sound similar to what we have the United States setting up in Iran with the Special Committees for Democracy, or the recent committee now set up for Cuba to destabilize Cuba that was just announced?
Or that which is prepared as we speak, and which we will detail in the Venezuela of Hugo Chavez.
Now, CIA and MI6 would instigate internal uprisings, for instance, he notes, by the Druze in the south, help free political prisoners held in the various prisons, and stir up the Muslim Brotherhood in Damascus. Isn't that similar, I ask you, to what the Mossad has done in Palestine with the support for Hamas?
And not only the Mossad, let us be clear, because Mossad was one of the creators of Hamas, along with Saudi intelligence, but it has been disclosed recently that the United States FBI was funding Hamas right through and including the Clinton years under the direction of Madeleine Albright during the Y negotiations, funding Hamas, the terror apparatus of the intelligence agencies itself, the suicide bombings to be laid at the door ultimately of U.S. intelligence.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, October 14th, 2003 on WBAI 99.5 FM in the tri-state region of New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today is part two of Outing the Gentleman Killers of the CIA. Part one is on our website, already in our program archive at www.takingaim.info.
Maya, let me just take a moment here to give the flavor of the documents drawn up in Washington by the top echelons of the CIA and the Secret Intelligence Services. They were to create political turmoil as the pretext for invading Syria, as we have indicated. They were to, in fact, organize operations that would demonize the Syrian regime. They were to above all, instigate false flag operations. CIA and SIS would use their capabilities in the psychological and action fields to augment terrorism, to organize sabotage, national conspiracies, strong-arm activities, and I'm quoting, in Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, responsibility for which would be attributed to Damascus. They would murder people, they would blow up things, they would carry out atrocities, all of which would be attributed to Damascus. These were operations in which the Special Action Section of the SIS and the Central Intelligence Agency specialized in such things in the 1940s and 1950s applying their MO to this campaign against Syria. Here is the modality of the false flag operations, of which September 11th is the little continuation of the standard procedure of the gangster state in fomenting the conditions for invasion, for permanent war, and the seizure of resources.
In prior programs some months ago of Who's Next, we discussed taking out Syria, taking out Iran, taking out Saudi Arabia, taking out China. And on October 11th in the Sydney Morning Herald, there was a startling headline revealing exactly what we have been discussing. Stalking Syria. The article continues. More terrifying than the bombs dropped near Damascus last week, referring to the Israeli bombing of a camp on October 5th, was the message they carried for the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Game over. game over. Only 4 days after that attack, the U.S. House of Representatives on October 9th, the International Relations Committee voted 33-2 to ban the export of, quote, dual-use technologies to Syria. The Syrian Accountability and Lebanese Sovereignty Act is sure to pass the full House, and George Bush will be empowered to ban American investments in Syria and freeze Syrian assets in the United States.
And this with the ardent support of all Democrats and Republicans alike. They're going to basically rob the bank. They're going to move into banks and seize Syrian assets. They will confiscate the hundreds of millions of dollars of the Syrian government and take it away from them. And indeed, Ariel Sharon, as the article states, closely synchronized his strike on Syria with political developments in the United States, says Joe Sirincione, an analyst with the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Before the Israeli strike, the administration was resisting sanctions. After it, they dropped their opposition and implemented them. Syria will answer this attack only through diplomatic means. Assad faces an invidious dilemma before he meekly accepts Israel's slap in the face. And it goes on to demonstrate that stalking Syria is the beginning of the application of the Cheney-Mossad neocon operation for dismantling each country in its turn. The road to Damascus, as the Christian Science Monitor detailed on October 8th, the Israeli air raid is a direct implementation of the plan to resolve this conflict with Palestine by dismantling each Arab government in its turn. The Road to Damascus and the Christian Science Monitor details the application of this plan, as was the intent of the neocons from the 1970s on, 9/11 providing them with their moment of opportunity.
Eyal Zeiser, a lecturer, a senior lecturer at Tel Aviv University, stated, quote, "Without American support, or at least the expectation of such support, this attack would not have taken place," referring to the strike against the Ain Sahib camp, which is only 20 kilometers northwest of Damascus. Now, if you look at another article that appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald, October 11th, by Douglas Gell, writing from Washington, you notice that, in fact, the United States didn't just give a green light to the Israelis to attack Syria, but in fact, the United States set up this attack. Listen and you'll see what I mean. U.S. spy satellite identified the Syrian camp. Quote, "American spy satellites showed that the Syrian target attacked by Israeli warplanes last weekend had been the site of recent construction, possibly to prepare it for use by the Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad," United States officials claim. But if you read this article closely, you see that, in fact, that this was an abandoned camp that hadn't been used for years, and in fact, that there probably had been very little construction. But most importantly is this sentence, quote, "The human intelligence had provided uncorroborated indications that the site might be used not just as a staging ground for attacks on targets inside Israel, but also for attacks against U.S. troops in Iraq," U.S. officials said. Notice, uncorroborated indications and might. Always might be used. Might be used by Islamic Jihad is also stated by the U.S. officials. Might be used for U.S. attacks against troops in Iraq and human intelligence. What do they mean by this human intelligence? They mean very people like Valerie Plame of the CIA.
The disinformation, the staged events. Here in Haaretz on the 7th of October, an article that was then disseminated by the Associated Press from Haaretz, while former President Bill Clinton was going through the motions of an elusive peace between Israelis and Palestinians, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was secretly funneling money to Hamas and inducing the militant group to use the funds for terrorist attacks. The counterterrorism operations in 1998 and 1999, having set up Hamas to carry out actions which would then be the pretext for response, was run out of the FBI's Phoenix office in cooperation with Israeli intelligence, approved by Attorney General Janet Reno, FBI officials told Associated Press Haaretz, October 7th, 2003. The pretext, the false flag operation, Democrats and Republicans alike, from Clinton to Bush Senior and Bush Junior, the standard operational procedure of the gangster state.
So we have here the collaboration of Israel and the United States. As before, in the 1950s, we saw the collaboration of Great Britain and the United States, also in discussions with Israel to attack Syria, to undermine Syria, and use that as an excuse to send U.S. troops into Syria, which was part of the Eisenhower doctrine that the U.S. would send troops into the Middle East to defend its hold over the oil of the region, the resources of the region. Now, very soon after the attack on Syria, which was on Sunday, the very next day on Monday, President Bush came out with the statement, quote, "Israel's got a right to defend herself, that Israel must not feel constrained in terms of defending the homeland." This was the statement of President Bush. And according to an Israeli official, "You don't ask for a green light, and you don't get a green light. In other words, you just go ahead and do it, and it is something that has been planned in collaboration between the Israelis and the U.S.
Well, they're not coy about it, Maya. On October 12th, the diplomatic memo article by Stephen R. Weissman in the New York Times, Sharon acts tough, sensing U.S. assent. And the article details how the attack on Syria was a pre-planned operation based upon United States, green light, but collusion in setting up the entire operation. This is hand in glove, like lips to teeth. The Mossad and the Central Intelligence Agency, the Zionist settler state rulers and their masters in Washington, partners in crime.
As noted by the Sydney Morning Herald with its reports about the U.S. spy satellite and the so-called human intelligence providing the basis or the pseudo-rationale for the attack. So what we have here is now coming out of Israel is the statements that this so-called base that was in Syria was actually being funded by the Iranians. And Ranan Nissan, who is an aide to Sharon, said, quote, "We will not tolerate the continuation of this axis of terror between Tehran, Damascus, and Gaza." And so he was echoing Bush's axis of evil rhetoric, setting up a stage for both the strikes that have also been in the news, the strikes against Iran, as well as strikes against Damascus, which have already begun, and the continuing strikes against the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza.
So let's see how this plays out. On October 8th, the Sydney Morning Herald article by Timothy Phelps in Washington about the Syria sanctions sailing through the U.S. Congress because the Bush administration has endorsed Israel's bombing of Syria and given the all clear to the U.S. Congress to institute the economic sanctions against Syria, which in essence is designed to do to Syria what was done to Iraq, which is to strangle the economy, to begin the process of eliminating food supplies, instituting epidemic disease and starvation to bring the regime to its knees. And indeed, this is the background to Israel, as the Reuters reported on October 8th, clearing the way to call up its army reservists. Clearing the way to call up its army reservists in anticipation of major war in the Arab East. And indeed, the reference that you made to the plans for Iran are also made clear. Israel, the Guardian reported on October 12th, is deploying nuclear arms in submarines. A detailed article by Peter Beaumont in London and Kunal Urquhart in Jerusalem in The Observer about the deployment of nuclear arms in submarines in preparation for major action. And on the 12th of October, Der Spiegel, Israel Insider, Israel is preparing strike to take out Iranian nuclear sites. And indeed, the Mossad plans for preemptive nuclear strikes in Iran were confirmed in Jerusalem. And here the story. Israeli press gripped by reports of nuclear war plans on Iran. Mossad has planned preemptive strikes to attack six nuclear presumptive nuclear sites in Iran. In other words, an all-out air attack on Iran in conjunction with the attacks on Syria. Yedid Aharonot, Ma'ariv, and Haaretz splashed a story that were carried in the Los Angeles Times report that modified U.S.-made cruise missiles carrying nuclear warheads on submarines are allowing Israel to launch atomic weapons from land, air, or sea, and are connected to the plans that Der Spiegel specified of special Mossad unit receiving offers to orders 2 months ago to prepare for imminent strikes on a half dozen targets in Iran.
According to Ma'ariv, Sharon told his associates, quote, Iran is the greatest danger to Israel, and that he was coordinating all the intelligence gathering efforts with the United States, quote, down to the last detail. And Mossad chief Meir Dagan was to devote, quote, his utmost efforts to gather the information about Iran's growing nuclear capabilities, but already the detailed plans have been prepared by the Mossad, according to Der Spiegel, to destroy the nuclear sites. Now, if you'll recall, in 1981, Israel did carry out a strike against Iraq's nuclear reactor at Osirak. Now, that was considered complex but feasible. According to the Israeli Air Force fighter jet pilots, the attack against Iran is much more complex since the sites are further from Israel and there are many more of them. Now, of course, there is no proof that Iran is developing any military nuclear policy when, in fact, Israel is known to have at least 200 nuclear weapons and many, many more. If you recall the exposures by Mordechai Vanunu many years ago, who's been in solitary confinement all these years for his exposures of the nuclear weapons developments by the Israeli Zionist state.
And indeed, Maya, the Osirak plant was not a nuclear arms plant any more than those are. They are in Iran. At the time in Iraq, there was the attempt to develop nuclear energy, much as the North Koreans have attempted to do so. In the absence of a sustainable means of providing power, in the face of sanctions, in the face of blockades, in the face of the deteriorated infrastructure. And leaving aside the question of the merit or lack of merit of nuclear power stations are not nuclear weapons plants, and the cynical operations of the Victoria Plames and the Joseph Wilsons and their counterparts in Central Intelligence were engaged in the disinformation to provide the rationale for the gangster attacks on sovereign states, the destruction of Osirak, the attack now on Syria, the pending attack on Iran, which services an agenda of global hegemony for the 2%, the 1%, in fact, of the 90% of our people that owns, the 1% of our population that owns 90% of the national wealth. That is the ruling class that has captured the state. That is the root of this criminal behavior of the gangster state that we've been detailing in this as in other programs.
Well, in the remaining minutes, let's look to the articulation of this agenda, which was made very clear in a 1996 document called A Clean Break that was prepared by Richard Perle and David Wormser for Benjamin Netanyahu for his campaign for prime minister in Israel. David Wormser is a member of the State Department Office of Arms Control, along with John Bolton, another war hawk, and he had worked under Vice President Dick Cheney and his Chief of Staff, Louis Libby. Formerly, he was with the American Enterprise Institute and the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. These are the neoconservative organizations. And along with Richard Perle of the Defense Policy Board, in years prior to his being on the Defense Policy Board, Wormser and Richard Perle crafted this document called A Clean Break, July 8, 1996.
Yes. 1996, right.
Ralph, do you want to go into the document?
Sure. The document is a virtual Mein Kampf. It's a blueprint, much as the Project for the New American Century is a blueprint. At the American Enterprise Institute, on October 7th, Leo Strauss, his acolyte William Kristol, acknowledged that the United States had been remiss in not, quote, already moving beyond the Iraq War to the next regime change and the next Middle East government to be removed. The 1996 document, The Clean Break, with Richard Perle of the Defense Policy Board and Don Rumsfeld and such, was the articulation of the necessity for a clean break from any attempt to mediate settlements with any of the regimes in the Middle East and for their instant and immediate overthrow.
It states specifically, one, destroy Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, blaming them for every act of the Palestinian, any act that is waged against the Zionist state. And two, induce the United States to overthrow Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. Three, launch a war against Syria after Saddam Hussein has been deposed. Four, parlay the overthrow of the Ba'athist regime in Baghdad and Damascus into what is so-called democratization of the Arab world, meaning the takeover, the privatization, the corporate control, and the setting up of proconsuls and pseudo-governments in these countries so they're under the direct rule of the Zionist state and the United States and the imperial control.
And the clean break, Maya, calls then for further military action against Iran, Saudi Arabia, and I quote, the ultimate prize, Egypt.
Sounds like the Ode de Nome document.
It is the Ode de Nome document.
Even with the words ultimate prize.
The ultimate prize is taken directly from Ode de Nome's document, a strategy for the 1980s, which was prepared in the late 1970s, which became the benchmark document for the National Security Agency and for the American Enterprise Institute and the Project for a New American Century. This document of Ode de Nome, the Mossad operative, called for the fragmentation of each Middle East country in its turn, and this very language of the clean break is derived specifically from that document. And setting up the Saudis, which we have documented over a period of time, every single time people cite the J. Michael Springman data on the visas that the CIA insisted were given to Saudi operatives to come into the United States in relation to 9/11, every single time this evidence is invoked on Pacifica and elsewhere, it is deployed to suggest that the Saudis on their own are involved and responsible for 9/11. As we said, in setting up the Saudis and taking out the Saudis, this is providing cover for the operation to destabilize and remove the Saudi regime itself. These Saudi operatives were indeed involved under the direct control and running of their masters in the Central Intelligence Agency. These people would not take a single quarter step without the approval and the sanction and the knowledge and the control of the ruling class in the United States and the Central Intelligence Agency. In particular, the ultimate prize, Egypt. For the first time in 30 years, Israel launched bombing raids against Syria, targeting a purported camp inside Syria. This is the opening note of the implementation of the Clean Break. The principal author of the Clean Break and a series of follow-on Institute of Strategic Policy Studies strategy papers long anticipated and prepared for this event, now under the desk of not just Dick Cheney, but of Wormser's wife, Merev Wormser, who was another of the Class Break authors, who was head of the Middle East policy at the Hudson Institute, which was heavily financed by Lord Conrad Black, owner of the Hollinger Corporation, and the sugar daddy to Richard Pearl, who was installed by Black at the Hudson Institute. And this is the think tank that has provided the propaganda. By the way, Merav Wormser received her doctorate for the glorifying of the life and works of Vladimir Jabotinsky, the founder of Revision Zionism, and the intellectual author of the policies of the Likud.
Ralph, I'd like to mention that one of the authors of the Clean Break, a new strategy for securing the realm, this 1996 document, was Douglas Feith, who is the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy, and whose name has been very much mentioned on our programs. David Wormser, as you mentioned, is now in the office of Vice President Dick Cheney. So the authors of this Target Syria document, moving on to targeting Egypt, targeting Iran, targeting Saudi Arabia, are very much within the power structure of the current Bush administration. We're out of time now. So in future, we'll have to deal with the CIA plans in Venezuela, as well as plans in countries throughout the world to destabilize, to seize control of the resources, to prevent the self-determination and aspirations of the peoples of the world.
Let me just say this, Maya, because as we are going to detail the plans to murder Hugo Chavez, the specific Central Intelligence Agency plans to murder him under the direction, by the way, of Charles Shapiro, a nominal State Department functionary and ambassador to Caracas, playing much the same role as Joseph Wilson IV and Victoria Plame.
Valerie
Plame. We speak of outing the killers, naming the names, what was so aptly described by Harrison Salisbury in his seminal article, The Gentlemen Killers of the CIA. Name the names, expose the plots, speak truth to power, identify the crimes.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, part two of Outing the Gentlemen Killers of the CIA. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or at our new email site, takingaim@wbai.org. You can also access our programs at our internet site, www.takingaim.info. I'd like to thank Kathy Davis for engineering at WBAI, Michael Yoshida for here at KPFA, and Bradley Wiedmeyer, who works with us each week on the production of our programs and without whom we wouldn't be producing Taking Aim. I want to remind you that the WBAI Fund Drive is starting, and Taking Aim will have a special 3-hour program next week, beginning at 3 p.m. and going till 6. So mark your calendars and be with us next week from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesday.
For revelations, for information, for mobilizing, and for activating, join us next week.
Our program will be The Underlying Politics of 9/11. Really?